Welcome to episode 33 of the Microsoft Cloud Show. In this episode, we're going to cover a little bit of news and go through some listener questions that have been sent in. Welcome to the Microsoft Cloud Show, the only place to stay up to date on everything going on in the Microsoft Cloud world, including Windows Azure, Office 365, SharePoint, Exchange, Link, and related technologies. Just the information, no marketing, no BS. I'm Andrew Connell.
And I'm Chris Johnson.
And we're just two dudes telling you how we see it. All right, here we are with episode 33. How are you doing today, CJ?
Everything is awesome, AC.
Well, I don't think everything is awesome. It might be on your side, but it is not on my side.
Yeah, I only say that because I was introduced to the Everything is Awesome song from the Lego movie. Mm-hmm. And it makes me laugh out loud every time I hear it. It's just hilarious.
The visual, have you seen the movie?
Pieces of it, not the whole lot.
Oh, you got to go see it. The visualizations of them when they're dancing and seeing like the Everything is Awesome music video at the very end is just seeing them dancing. That's the only thing I have in my head is them jumping around. So it's a great movie. Really good.
It just brings a smile to my face when I see my kids jumping around dancing to it, and it makes me laugh every time. So
it's a lot better than listening to the Frozen soundtrack over and over and over.
Oh my goodness, yeah, poke my eyes out with a stick.
So what have you been up to?
Well, we are thinking of moving house, so we've been sort of doing a whole bunch of stuff around the house, getting it ready to put it on the market.
Oh wow, that's a big deal.
Yeah. It's one of those things where you sit down and you talk to your partner or your wife or significant other. You're like, yeah, we should move house. And you're like, that's a great idea. And then you start working on all the stuff you've got to do to get it ready to move. And you're like, oh, this is such a bad idea.
Exactly. Oh, I know that. I know that feeling very well.
So I've been outside ripping out plants and tidying stuff up and running around doing chores and all the things you know you've got to do but just never get around to doing.
Mm-hmm. Not until you want somebody to see your house and give you more money for it.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So that's basically been my weekend these last couple of days, but we're getting there. It's looking really good. So
yeah, that's good
progress. Very cool. How about you?
I'm sick as a dog.
Yeah, you're still a bit blocked up, huh?
Yeah, I guess the last time we talked, I said I was dealing with a head cold or a sore throat. And this the day that we recorded, I went to a little clinic. They said I had strep throat, so I got stuck on penicillin. And then within a day, that changed into, while my sore throat got better, that changed into a serious sinus infection. So I got on medicine for that. And then apparently I have a allergic reaction now going from something that I was around all day yesterday. I was outside all day at my kid's swim meet in the morning and then had to mow my yard and my neighbor's yard, who's got he had shoulder surgery and he's mowed mine a few times. So it was my turn to mow his. And I didn't realize that I was allergic to something that I was around during the day yesterday, being outside all day until last night. So,
oh, dude,
I'm,
well, things typically come in threes, right? So, so you're on what, four?
yeah, somewhere around there. So it's been, I'm still dealing with some serious discomfort from, I'm in Boston right now getting ready to teach a class, the SharePoint SharePoint 2013 developer class, the Great SharePoint Adventure for Critical Path Training this week. And, had to fly up today and, you know, you got that sinus pressure going and you're always worrying about it when you're on the plane, but it's not until they start that descent and you're like, oh my God, does somebody have a nail just to tap into my sinuses and relieve some pressure?
Oh, I feel for you. I hate that. Well, hopefully you'll get better soon.
Oh, we'll hope so. I'm loaded with drugs right now. So we'll see if it's my students are going to get in one hell of a ride this week. So we'll see how they like it, but whatever.
Yeah. You just have to, drug up in the mornings and squish it down and then suffer later.
Pretty much. Yeah. So in this show, we're going to move on to the show. In this show, we got a couple things we're going to do. It's going to be kind of a news and questions. We're getting a few questions from people. One thing that I wanted to share real quick was I got a couple questions personally from back in, I think it was episode 31, that I shared that I was having a challenge with Azure Active Directory and Office 365, and I had that flat spot on my head. I was banging my head against it.
Yep.
ends up that there was nothing really wrong with Azure aside from the user interface not being very intuitive. So, and it was funny because everybody I explained this to, they all thought that there was a bug or functionality wasn't available. Ends up, just as a quick recap, what I was trying to do was I have a Azure subscription that is tied to a Microsoft account, my primary Microsoft account, and I had renamed that to use my personal email address way back in the day, way before organizational IDs and all that stuff came up with 365. So then, with Office 365, I wanted to take the Azure AD that my 365 was backed by and add that to my Azure subscription so that I could log in with my org account, which was more secure, over to my, or just a better practice, and use that to administer my SharePoint or my Azure subscription. And every time I was trying to add the, well, I got the my Azure subscription to see the Office 365 Azure AD directory, I was having a very hard time trying to get adding my account to be administrator access to both of them. And what I was telling people the problem was is it kept only seeing my Microsoft account. Well, apparently what you have to do is you have to first go in to the subscription in Azure and you have to tell it to use a different AD than what it's currently using, a different directory. I was using the default directory that they created for every single subscription, which for me, it was just the Andrew Connell
directory.
But my Office 365 subscription, I created that under my company name. And I, you know, as you can tell, I'm terribly creative because my company is named Andrew Connell Incorporated or Andrew Connell Inc., which I never use that anywhere except in legal stuff. So I had two directories, Andrew Connell and Andrew Connell Inc. And when I went to manage it, it never occurred to me that there was not an Inc. on the end of one of them. So once I switched it over, went back in, logged in, did a couple little other little obvious things, and then poof, when I went in to add it, all of a sudden it started working.
Nice. So, hey, you should blog about this.
I need to. It's on my
list. Because it wouldn't surprise me if there are others falling into exactly the same trap.
Yeah, and you know, I started to, and here's the problem. I have no way to do any screenshots or do the exact steps that I did because you don't really want to unravel it, and it's already done. So it's kind of, and the way that the UI works is that when you go to change from one directory to another one, it doesn't show you all of your directories. It shows you all directories that are that you have that you can switch to minus the one that you're currently in.
And yeah, gotcha.
So it doesn't, it's not terrible. It wasn't terribly obvious, and especially if they're named something similar. So,
but yeah, this also sounds like it ties into a question we're going to have a little later in the show. So, we should also talk about that.
Definitely does. So there's my update there. I will put a blog post out about it explaining what the challenge was and what I ran into. I need to somehow find a way to get better screenshots to share with people. But
yeah.
At any rate.
Oh, I'm glad you got it figured out.
Yeah, definitely. So, okay, cool. So let's jump onto the news here.
Yeah.
So there's been a bunch of news that's happened in the last week. We got three items here that we definitely want to touch on. Why don't you start us off and pick one of your favorite ones that you want to touch on here?
I think the one we should probably start with is some news this last week coming that Microsoft has made it into the Gartner Magic Quadrant, into the leader box for its IaaS offering. So for those of you who aren't familiar with the Gartner Magic Quadrant reports, Gartner, the analyst firm, put out a report. There's different reports for different areas of the industry, but one of the ones that they put out is around cloud infrastructure as a service. They also put out another one for platform as a service. And a little while back, Microsoft made a leap into the leader quadrant. So when these reports are put out, they put this little graph together and it's made up of four quadrants. There's a challenges quadrant, leaders quadrant, niche players quadrant, and visionaries quadrant. And so they put the different people on that, you know, on that graph, and we'll link off to a post about this in the show notes so you can see what I'm talking about here. But basically, depending on which quadrant you're in, it sort of indicates on a scale of sort of 0 to 100 your ability to execute, and then along the other axis, completeness of vision. And so depending on you know, how good you are on ability to execute and how good you are on completeness of vision, they'll put you in one of these different quadrants. But like I said, it's probably easier to see than me describe. Previously, Microsoft had made it into the leaders quadrant for the platform as a service, or they call it APAS, which is short for Enterprise Application Platform as a Service metric quadrant. But they've got another one for Cloud Infrastructure as a Service, or IaaS. And the recent metric quadrant report that came out placed Microsoft in the leaders quadrant, which is sort of the highest quadrant you can get on ability to execute and completeness of vision. And they only share that quadrant with AWS. So there's only two providers in that leaders quadrant. Everybody else is either down in the niche players quadrant or in the visionaries quadrant, but don't quite have the ability to execute quite the same as AWS or Microsoft. So that was kind of really important because a lot of companies look at the things that, or the analysis and recommendations that Gartner put out, and Forrester and the other analyst firms, to help guide their decision-making process when it comes to technology. And so, you know, being in this space or in this quadrant is really important to the people that put the technology out, because they know that customers are going to look at them.
Yeah, this is a big deal because, I mean, like you said, a lot of companies are going to look at it and say they're only going to consider companies that are in the metric quadrant in specific areas.
So it's really I think important now that that Microsoft Azure is both in the platform as a service and in IaaS, where it was only previously in the PaaS one previously.
Yeah, that's a big win. That's a big deal for them. So it's good to see that. I mean, I'm very pleased with their offering. And I mean, Amazon is still kind of seen as the big dog in the cloud space. I did see that they did have Google made it into this list for the first time. And the article that we'll link off to, it's on the Windows IT Pro website, and it's the article that explains kind of what all this means is by a guy named Rod Trent. And one of the things he said, I found this interesting about the Google stuff, where it said that while Google was seen as a visionary and they were added just this year, it carries caution, while Gartner actually sees this as a strength. And I share what I share what his opinion is. It says the company wants to force customers to run like Google, which it sounds a lot like in his eyes is, quote, do it our way or go somewhere else. I have to agree with that a little bit, because it would seem to me that I like the way that Amazon and Microsoft really treat their IaaS offerings. It's just, look, we're just taking care of the hardware for you and giving you a bunch of different virtual machine instances. What you do with them and how you use them, we really don't care.
Yeah, people are much more familiar with that, right, than having to pick a different set of technologies and a different way of doing things.
Yeah. I mean, and who's to say, Google has their own unique problems. So how are their problems going to really relate to other companies that are out in the business world? So
yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
So another really big piece of news here that happened this week. And I know you've had a few people that have asked us about this on Twitter, and they were saying they were interested to hear what our opinion is on it. And, maybe a bit of a letdown, I would say, but there was a big announcement earlier last week, I should say, that Microsoft and Salesforce have an announcement where they are doing a lot more work together, specifically around having Salesforce apps for Windows 8, for Windows Phone, also some really good tie-ins with Salesforce for Office 365. So you've got things like Access and Share and Collaborate on Office content straight from within Salesforce. Using Office Mobile, Office for the iPad, and Office 365, using OneDrive for Business and SharePoint Online as integrated storage options within Salesforce, use Salesforce and Outlook together with a new app that we're going to have with Salesforce app within Office and Outlook, and then connect Salesforce data to Excel and Power BI for Office 365 to visualize information and find new insights. So it's all very cool stuff. I mean, the press release is, in my mind, the press release is a little bit vague on where we're going with this. It's a classic kind of corporate press release. It's a big deal because there's going to be a lot more concentrated work between the two companies, and it's going to benefit customers who are customers of both 365 and Salesforce. It's going to be interesting to see how this is addressed, or how this plays out with things like Microsoft CRM and the other Dynamics tools that they have that kind of have a bit of an overlap with Salesforce.
I definitely take your point on, you know, not all of the details being spelled out in the press release, and the proof will really be in the pudding, right? But I think for me, the really interesting thing about this is that, you know, historically, Mark Benioff has not been the most Microsoft-friendly guy on the planet. And he also leads one of the cloud's sort of biggest cloud software applications, for want of a better word, right? Salesforce is gigantic in the cloud world. And I just think the fact that the two companies are working together like this, you know, talking and are getting in a broad partnership like this is very, very telling, right? That they want to do great stuff together. And I'm a bit biased, right? I work for Microsoft, so I work for the Office 365 team, which has got, you know, bits of this puzzle that you saw in the press release, or pieces of the announcement. And so I just see it as all good, right? It's having somebody like Salesforce working together with Microsoft is going to be huge, I think.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, you make some really good points. He's never been a big Microsoft cheerleader, a big fan of Microsoft. And also, like you said, when you look at companies, when you go to the industry and you say, give me some, when you go to the industry and say things like, you know, give me a good example of a PaaS or of an IaaS or of a software as a service offering as a SaaS, Salesforce is always one of the biggest ones that always comes up, right? You see, especially on the business side, it might be the biggest one. After you said that, I've been trying to think of another one that would be considered bigger for a software as a service, aside from like that's more than just email, more than just like a Google Maps or, you know, Outlook.com and Gmail or stuff like that, or search. I mean, think of something that companies are actually going out and paying for. Office 365 is now one of the big ones as well. But Salesforce is always seen as one of the big leaders there. So, I mean, it's something we've, a lot of companies model how they do updates and how they run their business. They've been a trendsetter. So,
yeah, and they have been, you know, in the cloud since day one. Mm-hmm. And they're definitely one of the big business apps in the cloud that sort of leads the charge on a lot of those things. So, yeah, it's going to be fascinating. I guess the outcome of this is stay tuned and see what actually happens.
Yep, definitely. Yeah, we'll see where this goes. And then the last bit of news here, you want to talk about something that Microsoft bought to beef up Azure.
Yeah, sure. So Microsoft recently bought a French company, if I'm not mistaken. I believe they're headquartered out of Paris, called Captain, CAPPTAIN, which is a mobile app management platform. And basically, I haven't actually used this, so hopefully I'm not speaking out of turn here, but Captain mostly focused on mobile analytics, and in particular around notifications based on usage patterns of customers and things. So I'm guessing, and I say this very much so because I really have had no insight into you know, what's going to happen with this product or this company in Azure. I'm not speaking out of knowing anything about what's going on internal at Microsoft here, but I'm guessing it's going to help push some new features into Azure that help give better insights to developers down the track about what's happening in their apps.
Mm-hmm. So kind of like application insights, but very specific into their apps, giving them a lot more information than what we get with application insights. Something like that, you think?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I think it'd be it's one of the sort of hot button areas right now, is making sure that developers have all of the tools and the insight into what's happening in their applications and what their customers are doing, to better design their apps and give customers what they want. And I think this plays into that space.
Mm, very interesting. That's a cool announcement. Yeah, so we'll have all the links to all these news announcements. We'll have these in the show notes, so you can go check out those things there. That kind of wraps up the news part of the show that we wanted to go over. We have also been asking people to send in questions. We haven't done a whole lot of questions lately with people. So before we move on to the questions part of our show, we had a question that was sent in that goes along great with the segment that we started a couple weeks ago, which is, you want to ask us a question, send a question in about absolutely anything, CJ and I will answer it, provided it's clean. So we got Thomas Volsten sent the question in. Forgive me if I missed your name, but it's Thomas Volsten. Sent the question in, says he loves the show, SharePoint MVP. He loves the show. Says, my question for the everything you always wanted to know but were afraid to ask section is, if you could change just one single thing in SharePoint, what would it be? Keep up the good work. In kind regards, Thomas Volsten. So first, thank you very much for sending the question in.
That's awesome.
And so, CJ, if there was one thing that you could change about SharePoint, what would it be?
Gosh. I would have to say the hierarchical nature of its storage system. And by that I mean, if you know anything about SharePoint, you know, it basically is a hierarchy of sites and lists, right? So you have a site collection, and inside that you have sites, and sites can have subsites, and then any site can have, you know, a document library or a list, and then document libraries can have folders within it and so forth. But the way this works under the covers is a site collection is bound to a particular database behind the scenes. And so historically that's meant things like being able to scale SharePoint there's been some limitations on it based on how much you can put in a particular site collection or a site or a list, because it ultimately maps down into a database, and you can have multiple site collections in a database. Now this has held SharePoint back in a couple of ways over the years, and I think to this day it probably still suffers a little bit from this architectural decision made probably, I don't know, at least 10 years ago now. So if there was one thing I could change about SharePoint, it'd be to sort of go back in time and figure out a better way to do the site and storage system behind the scenes, so it wasn't a direct mapping to one site collection to one database.
You've got to be kidding me. It's pretty obvious that the two of us are on the same page, because that is exactly the same thing I was going to say. My reasoning is a little bit different, but that's exact. I kind of go part with the organization of how they store everything, which is kind of the underlying data store in SharePoint and SQL Server, and is the cause for some of the performance challenges that we have. When you try and use SharePoint in a way it wasn't designed to be used, is all driven based on this logical structure of site collection and then subsites. For me, I would love to have the ability to, for almost all the stuff that SharePoint has to offer, like hosting workflows and doing standard document management stuff and records management and all that stuff, I would like to be able to have those things provided to me as a service and use those in my own custom applications without having to shoehorn my application into the way that SharePoint does its stuff with sites and site collections, and how when you install an app, you get these little app webs and stuff like that. I mean, I'm right there with you. I'm sitting here listening to this. I took my glasses off, put my hand in my head, just going, well, should I come up with something else?
Hey, you just stole my answer.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say.
So the thing about this, right, is it's interesting, because there are also a lot of benefits that come from having it the way it is, and we shouldn't lose sight of those. But definitely over time, it's caused a bunch of pain and suffering, and it's really interesting for another reason, because when I first moved to the States, I joined the SharePoint engineering team. What was back then, it was the WSS team. And on my interview loop, I interviewed with a guy called Ambrose Tracy, who some of our listeners may be familiar with him. He's been on the engineering team for a long time, and great guy, Irish guy, wonderful, wonderfully hilarious fellow. And he actually asked me, he said to me, what do you think one of the biggest limitations of SharePoint is currently? And what would you change about it? And I have the exact same answer back then, which was about 7 years ago.
Huh.
And we discussed in the interview how I would change it and how what I would do to make it better. And so it's interesting. I haven't changed my answer for the last 7 years on this.
Yeah, it's funny you say that because I don't think you and I have ever talked about this. And
no,
it's just funny to have that come up. I already like this segment.
But, you know, but I also think it's probably not all that uncommon as well. It's probably a bunch of other people that think the same thing. But having been in the space for a while, you know that over time we've had these different storage and perf limits based on some of the underlying infrastructure, and a lot of it boils back to this hierarchical storage nature.
Yeah, yeah, and I agree with you. I'm not saying that the product team made a bad decision. The decisions were made at the time for the right reasons, and we are where we are today because certain decisions were made. I mean, it's a good product, but
hindsight's a wonderful thing.
Oh, it always is. Absolutely. It'd be great in sports betting. But anyway.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool. Well, so thank you very much for that question, Thomas. Okay. So let's dive into a few listener questions here. But we've got two that have been recorded and sent in. So why don't we go ahead and play the first one? The first one is by Brendan Ford. I'm going to let you take the first two audio questions here, CJ, because you actually know a little bit more about both of these than I do.
Sure.
So let's go ahead and play Brendan's question about Yammer API development.
Yeah, hi, AC and CJ. Brendan Ford here from Provoke Solutions down in New Zealand. I thought I'd just actually jump on the show and ask a bit of a question. We've been doing a bunch of development work against the Yammer API, and it kind of seems that maybe Yammer doesn't have the same rigor that Microsoft has around managing releases and managing APIs, and thus we're finding things are maybe changing under our feet. Keen to hear your sort of guidance on, you know, how you view it and how you see the world with regards to developing solutions against Yammer. And keen to hear whether you think maybe we're just diving too early and we should cool off a little bit. Cheers, and look forward to your answer.
Cool. So thanks for the question, Brendan. So CJ, what's your take on this?
Yeah, so I think what Brendan's getting at here is there's really a couple of parts to this. One is, what's up with the Yammer API? Why does it break often? This nature of not having it doesn't have quite the same rigor as some of the other areas of Microsoft development. So I think in that case, you know, Yammer build and release software much faster than Microsoft's sort of 3-year cycle. You know, Yammer were born in the cloud, so to speak. Sorry to use buzzword bingo there. But, you know, they've been on the super fast release cadence for years, right? And that has pros and cons. The pros are you get features out faster and you're able to iterate on them quicker. But some of the cons include, you know, if you do something wrong, then it also makes it into customers' hands a little faster than you would wish. Whereas Microsoft would spend basically a year after the end of every version of SharePoint for on-prem was developed, it'd basically be in testing and beta for about a year before it was released into production use for customers. So it went through a ton of rigor. And so I think it's a real balancing act between trying to get stuff out faster and being rigorous and not breaking things. So hopefully, you know, hopefully that balance will get to a good spot, and we'll see things break less frequently in their API with a bit more rigor introduced. But at the same time, you know, they're also helping the folks from Microsoft understand how to deliver software faster too. So hopefully it'll be a nice sort of medium there. And then the second part to that question is you know, are we keen to hear if it's too early? And so what I thought I could do is just give you a little bit of an insight into what's going on with the Yammer APIs, and specifically because I work on the 365 team that work on APIs and our developer story. And so currently the Yammer APIs are quite a different beast from the rest of 365. Although you still use OAuth and they're REST-based services with JSON payloads and things, they're not integrated into the same API space as the rest of 365. And so that work is that we're obviously very acutely aware of that. And that will change over time. And there's definitely work going on around this to help converge not only just APIs, but the authentication system and so forth as well. So things will definitely change over time as we move forward in this regard.
You know, it's funny listening to you. It's interesting listening to you talk about, you know, how the first part of Brendan's question about how frequently the API is coming out, when it breaks, and the frequency of the development. I know that, you know, one of the big reasons that Microsoft bought Yammer was not so much just for the social piece, but also it was for that rapid release culture. I think that with a company that's going to do more services stuff, that's just something that you need to have. And you need that kind of attitude. You look at, I mean, I'm a little familiar with what Facebook's development cycle looks like. I talked to a friend of mine who was a Facebook developer, or worked for the Facebook engineering for a while, and said the way that their process works is that you essentially are developers. Developers are put in a couple different classes, but let's just say you're a developer that's got a really, that's very senior, or at least has a very good track record and stuff doesn't break. When you commit something, it can go right into, if it passes all of its tests, it goes straight into production. But when it goes into production, it's released to like 10 servers, and then it stays there, and all of their monitoring watches the performance of the server and the performance of the application, looking for errors or any of that kind of stuff. And if there's any problems, they have to fix it. They fail forward. If things are good after a certain amount of time, that change then gets rolled out to 100 servers, and then 1,000 servers, and then 5,000 servers, and then 10,000, and then 30,000, all the way up to the 60,000 servers that run Facebook. Now, what's different about that is that if you're a brand new developer and you don't have any kind of a track record, any kind of a reputation at Facebook, then your stuff isn't going to get committed. When you commit it, it's not going to get straight into production. It may go into this little purgatory area where another senior developer who does have that kind of right has the ability to start pushing your changes into the main branch that's going to roll out into production, and then it starts to trickle through. Hearing how these different cloud companies are doing this, hearing how they're pushing stuff out, it's a very new style. It's a very new style, very rapid cadence style of pushing this stuff out. So I think it's very, very cool how they're doing this.
Yeah, like I said, I think it's going to be a balancing act, right? You want to move at the speed of light, right? But also stay safe and solid and have good rigorous practices too. So somewhere in the middle there is where I think we'll see things balance out.
All right, so another question here was by someone named Lynn Dye, who recorded her question as well and sent it in. It's around the custom domain service. So let me go ahead and roll her question and let you take a stab at that.
Hi, Andrew and CJ. My name is Lynn Dye, and I'm a listener since the beginning. I heard about your show from Todd Clint. And I'm a bit of a Microsoft enthusiast, not a developer or anything like that. And I was wondering if either of you had any insight into the changes Microsoft is making to the custom domain service. I was using that service and I applied my name using their custom domain service, and now they are trying to switch people over to Office 365. However, I don't really understand what is going on. Part of their email I got said, "As a current customer, we will continue to support the ability to log into Outlook.com with your existing custom domain email address, but as of July 31st, you will no longer be able to add or remove accounts in your domain." Well, it doesn't tell me anything about, I mean, can I still keep the service I have? If I don't need to add or remove any, if I'm just using it for myself, is that going to go away? They really don't address that. And I'm wondering if you guys could look into that and maybe let some of us know what's going on with that service. Thanks a lot. Love your show.
All right, cool. Thanks for the question, Lynn. Now, I don't have any experience or any insight into this, so I'm going to let CJ take this one.
Yeah, so what Lynn was talking about here is a service that Microsoft provides for custom domains. And so you can go to domains.live.com is the entry point for the service. And you can tell it's kind of old and withered because it shows a lot of the old Live branding. And so it doesn't look like the service has been updated in quite some time. But basically what it let you do was load one of your domain names, your vanity domain or custom domain, and load it into the Live service. And then you could create mailboxes and so forth based on Hotmail at the time, now Outlook.com, based off that. And so, you know, if you had a family domain or a small business or something like that, you could go in there and add the custom domain in and then create mailboxes off that, and away you go. Now, what happened is that's being, I don't know if the right word to use is shut down, but certainly no longer improved. And they've sent out a note saying, hey, if, you know, we're not going to accept new custom domains on this thing. We're going to keep your old ones running, but you're not going to be able to add new domains to the service. And we would instead guide you to go to Office 365 to do that. And to me, this makes quite a bit of sense because, especially for small business, where, you know, which was predominantly the main usage for this, right? Where you had, say, you know, 3 or 5 or 10 people working for your organization and you wanted to provide, you know, vanity domains with mailboxes attached for each person. And that is an absolute dead sitter for the Office 365 service, right? Where you're able to add a vanity domain, add mailboxes, manage them and so forth, and give everybody email on your domain, plus do all the stuff with SharePoint and Link and Office and things like that you'd want to as well. And so I think basically from my point of view, what happened over time was you know, Microsoft ended up with a better service in Office 365 and that let you do all a lot more robust management and complex complex features, or I guess robust feature sets, and sort of went, well, there's no point in having two of these services that do a similar thing. Let's go with the Office 365 one that gives you so much more. The only downside of that is the custom domain service, the live service, previously was free, whereas Office 365 is obviously a paid-for service, and in most cases anyway. And that so that's a bit of a downside there. But I think just overall, it just seemed like a dead sitter for Office 365 and what people were using it for.
Yeah, and it kind of, if I'm not mistaken, too, it kind of falls in line to being a little bit more along the same lines of what the competition does, like Google does with Gmail and their custom domains, where you have to pay for that. That's not a free service as well, correct?
Yeah, that's, as far as I understand, that's correct. Yeah.
Yeah, with Google Apps and stuff. So cool.
Yeah.
Thanks for the question, Lynn. Last question we're going to do today is one that was sent in by Dean Gross. So Dean sent it in via text. So let me go ahead and read it real quick. I'm going to summarize a little bit because it's a fairly longer question, but the question is around the area of sandbox quotas. So the question is, we're trying to determine when we need to increase the server resource quota value from the default of 300, as well as what appropriate value should be used. The instructions at change the server resource quota for a site collection tell us that quotas are used to manage risk from custom code, but they don't provide any guidance about the valid settings. These instructions imply that the only reason to change the setting is when we'll be adding custom code, but we have learned that the OneDrive site provisioning process required additional server resources. We're also seeing evidence that workflows created with SharePoint Designer do not work as expected unless the resource quota is increased from the default 300. These types of experiences are making us wonder what the other situations will require changing the setting. Could you please find answers to the following questions? First, what services in 365 require default values to be increased? 2, what are the maximum and minimum values for the setting? 3, what are the recommended practices for changing the setting? 4, when a new site collection is created, when should we assign more than 300 resources? And 5, how can this setting be changed via PowerShell or CSOM? Wow, a lot of questions there. So first, the one thing that I'm going to say that strikes me as a bit kind of was eye-opening was that you were saying that you've seen some stuff to where OneDrive provisioning and creating workflows with SharePoint Designer and stuff, that those things are affecting the resource, the server resources. That's news to me. CJ, have you seen that?
No, that was also news to me. I'd want to do a little more digging on background on that because I'm not familiar with that being the case.
Yeah, so that was my take too, because the server resource quota, that's all coming from the sandbox. And with SharePoint Design, the only way you can get stuff in the sandbox is to create things called sandbox solutions. So first of all, with SharePoint Designer, you can't create anything in a solution in SharePoint Designer because SharePoint Designer has no understanding of what solutions or even apps are. So I don't understand really how a workflow you create with SharePoint Designer, unless you created it as a reusable workflow, exported it, and then imported it into another site collection. And you would do that using as a sandbox solution. But still, there's no reason that you're going to have to bump it up from the default number. The default number that we have, so I guess to answer your first question then, or the first and maybe second or third question, is, you know, what services require the default values to be increased? Well, nothing requires you to increase those numbers. It's all based on usage. So the more resources you use on the server from the sandbox, the more points you're going to need to have in that allocation. You know, why did they pick 300? Well, I talked with some of the people that were involved in this when this first came out, way before SharePoint 2010 was released. And I asked them, I said, why 300? They said, we really don't know. We think that that's a good number. So far, it looks like a good number, but customers are free to change it based on their business. So there's no real science behind it, at least from the way my understanding is with it. In terms of what are the recommended practices for changing these settings, I wouldn't really say that there's anything that's recommended. You know, if you look at Office 365, you get a certain amount of resources that you can leverage, and then you then need to pay for additional quota to go through and to go above that number. So you're only going to have a certain amount of resources you can use across all of your site collections. Using the default of 300, in my experience, 300 has been acceptable in like 9 times out of 10. I rarely see where we've had to go above 300.
I think the other one of the interesting questions I've got here for our caller is, you know, what are you doing in those solutions? So if it's really heavy code, then there's two things on that. One is, could it be a potential candidate to move out of the sandbox and into a better code host, like into Azure, and using something like the new application model to do so? Or is it something that sort of needs to be as a sandbox solution, and taking a look at how heavy or light that process is, or the resource requirements are? Like AC, you know, like you said, AC, I don't think there's a specific guide here on must have X amount of resources, because you could write, you know, code that is very, very heavy, that chews it all up really fast, or it could be very, very light that, you know, you may get away with 300 for a long time. So it really depends, I think.
Yeah, and the last question, I completely agree with what you said. And the last question that he had was, can you change the setting in PowerShell or with the client object model? With the client object model, I'm not sure. With PowerShell, yes, you absolutely can. I don't know if you can do it with PowerShell on Office 365, but if you're on-prem, you definitely can. You just want to look at the site collection object. You'll find something in there where it talks about quotas. It's the same thing, the same quotas that refer to the size of a site collection in terms of the amount of disk space in the database. It's the exact same place you'll look for. You'll find that in that same quota, there's just an extra setting there where you can also set the server resources as well. Cool.
Yeah, gotcha. Yeah, there's definitely on-prem, there's you can tweak all about those quotas. Yeah, I'm not 100% sure about the 365 angle on that.
Yeah.
Oh, one more point on that is, if you are doing a whole bunch of code in a sandbox solution, it's probably worth pointing out that code in sandbox solutions has now been deprecated. So at some point in the future, it may disappear. So, and not to your recycle bin. I mean, the ability to run code in a sandbox solution at some point will get turned off.
Yeah. There's a thing called the user code service, which is it's an underlying service that essentially is the executable that runs all the managed code that's in a sandbox. That's the part that's been deprecated. That's the part where people thought that sandbox solutions have been deprecated. We don't know when that's going to be completely turned off, but eventually that will be turned off. You won't lose anything except that your code won't run. Another option too, though, is if the app model is not an option for you, as CJ mentioned, and moving it to something like Azure or another place to host your code, another option that you could do that we used a lot with the sandbox solutions was we moved everything to the client and did everything with JavaScript. And then you don't incur any points for that because it's running in the client. It's not running on the server.
Yeah, it's only server resources you're consuming.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, good question, Dean. So Brendan, Lynn, and Dean, thank you very much. You're going to get a podcast coffee cup when we start doing podcast coffee mugs.
Perfect. Yeah, there you go. Nothing like selling forward.
Exactly.
Hey, I've got a new review. We should quickly cover off before we wrap.
Oh, shoot! Go for it.
Okay, so this is a 5-star review in iTunes by Stuart Island. Great show, lads. Love the fact you guys talk about companies and solutions that are not just Microsoft, as MS has a bunch of competition out there. So that's thank you very much, Stuart Island, for sending that review in. Love getting the 5-star reviews, and we really appreciate taking the time to go throw your comment into iTunes. So encourage others to do so too.
Thank you very much, Stuart Island. We are coming to your island to have a celebratory drink for the 5-star review.
Excellent. Out of our non-existent coffee mugs.
Out of non-existent coffee mugs and on the yet-to-be-leased Gulfstream 5.
Perfect. Perfect.
Awesome. Thanks a lot, guys. We will see you in the next show.
Cheers.
If you have a question for us, go to microsoftcloudshow.com/questions, where you can submit it as text or record it as a WAV or an MP3 file and provide a link so that we can play your question on the show. Our theme music is an excerpt from Evaporated Eric by Monk Turner, used under Creative Commons. You can subscribe to us in iTunes by searching for the Microsoft Cloud Show or via RSS at microsoftcloudshow.com, where you'll also find a full transcript and show notes of each episode. You can find us on Facebook searching for the Microsoft Cloud Show or on Twitter at MS Cloud Show. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.